all of my children. Now I've got 18 grandchildren and one great-grandchild. I get along wonderfully with my grandchildren. I remarked that to a friend. He said, sure, grandchildren and grandparents get along beautifully. They have a common enemy. They're distributed all over the United States. My wife and I practice planted parenthood. We planted them all the way from New Haven to San Francisco. So I take on speaking engagements partly in order to see them. I retired 9 years ago. I lost my wife 5 years ago. She was suffering from multiple myeloma, which is a form of cancer. But there was a period in between the 3 years of her illness when she was somewhat better due to medication, and she wanted to go on a trip to East Africa. And the doctors knew what would happen in the end, but he said, go, live to the full. And we went. And she loved every minute of it, every minute of it. The day before she collapsed, she was going to go to that place where you climb up a wooden ladder and sit on a platform and watch all the animals come to water at night. But that day she collapsed. She was a month in the hospital at Nairobi. She just loved the Indian and the English nurses. They had such soft, gentle voices. And the English doctor was wonderfully kind. He said to me, she's losing ground. The only possible hope is your specialist at home. He knew the president of Pan Am and went to him and got it arranged one day to take her back. And at 11 o'clock at night, he went down to the airfield to kiss her goodbye. She lived only 2 months after we came home. Well, she was a mother in Israel. We were always entertaining students. She entered into their lives in a very unusual way. And now after my retirement, I spend my days in writing and traveling and lecturing. I live almost next to the Divinity School, eat with the students in the Divinity School morning and evening, and then I go downtown a mile away to the big university library where the Reformation collection is housed. And although I'm retired, they've allowed me to keep the study. They say I can keep it as long as I'm productive, so publish or perish. But I've managed to keep enough going so they haven't thrown me out. So I spend the day in the big university library, and then I eat in one of the colleges close by. I had just one room near the school, but I have a little cottage 22 miles away. I sold the big house. I have a little cottage on the shore of a lake formed by a dam in the Housatonic River. It's small, but it's winterized. It's on a thermostat in the winter. I can get it up from 50 to 75 in 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. So I have students down practically every weekend, or some of the continuing education group. I live in a house where groups come in, ministers, social workers, priests, rabbis, black, white, male, female, usually for 12 days at a time. And members of the faculty give them lectures, and they have study periods. I lecture once usually at each group, and usually take them down to my cottage. And we have an outdoor cookout or an indoor cookout, and a very simple kind of a meal, and chat together, so that I have that association. So of all men of my age and situation, I should say I am the most fortunate, with children, with friends, with health, with work that I love and that I'm able to do. So I am singularly blessed.
I was curious to know what made you interested in the Reformation in particular and Enlightenment?
The Reformation in particular, conscientious objection. I was wrestling with the problem of conscience and the community and the state. And I was concerned with heretics of the Reformation. I intended to write my first book on four heretics, one from Spain, one from Italy, one from France, and one from the Netherlands, who fled from the Roman Catholic Inquisition to the Swiss cities and there fell foul of the Calvinist regime And one was burned, and one was exiled, and one died during his trial, and one was exhumed, and they burned his ashes completely dead after he'd been dead a few years. Well, it was the problem of the objector, the theory of persecution. And I intended to do that in one volume, but I got a fellowship to go abroad to work on these people, and I found so much on every one of them that in the end it turned out I did four volumes. But they're not all available in English. One was published in German only and one in Italian only, because I had to help pay for it, and in the 30s it was cheaper to publish abroad, so those two books have never come out in English. But I did summarize them in a little book called The Travail of Religious Liberty. So it was the problem of religious liberty, of tolerance, of the duty of conscience, of the rights of conscience, how far the church or the state is and perhaps must interfere with the conscience of the individual. Well, after working on all of the minor figures of the Reformation, I felt I would never understand the situation if I didn't deal with the major figures, and I was invited to do a book on Luther. It was rather curious. Simon & Schuster, a secular house, during the war, asked me if I'd do a life of Luther. I said, what do you want it for? I said, do you want me to make him into a Nazi and damn him? They said, no, we'd like to present a great German to the American public when the war is over. I said, well, that sounds all right. But you know, there'll have to be a lot of religion in it or it won't be Luther. I said, I think we better have no agreement. I'll go to work on it. When I get it done, you can see. It took me 8 years. When I got it done, the man who asked me wasn't in their company anymore. And their new editors looked it over and they said, well, it's not our kettle of fish. So it was taken by the Abingdon Press. So it came about, well, in a sort of accidental way, somebody asked me to do it. And after I got steeped in it, I got excited. So I've been going back and forth between major figures and minor figures. The last big biography was of Erasmus, Luther's great Catholic opponent. You couldn't understand the Reformation unless you understood the Catholic side of the picture too. And Erasmus was very much of a liberal and defender of heretics against persecution. But now I'm on minor figures again, right, working on the biographies of the women. After all, the leaders wouldn't have gotten anywhere if there hadn't been somebody to lead. And we've got to understand the lesser people. And the real groundwork of a movement like the Reformation isn't done by one man who writes a lot of tracts, but by a multitude of little people who work it out in the local scale. So I'm interested in the little people of the Reformation. But as for other periods, I have written on the whole history of the church. I wrote a history of the church for about 12-year-olds called The Church of Our Fathers. The Presbyterians used that in their Sunday schools for some 30 years or so. I got my daughter, 12 years old, to help me with the index. She said, Daddy, I think you better leave God out of it. He's everywhere. Then I did another history of Christianity from Abraham to Pope John. That was the Horizon History of Christianity, gorgeously illustrated. But I wasn't too happy over the text because it was too subordinated to the pictures. So I did the whole thing over again with an eye to a student audience. And it was published with a different title by Harper's, with the title Christendom in two volumes. And in England, in the Penguin paperbacks, with the title The Penguin History of Christianity. So I have written up and down the line. And then I did a history of training for the ministry at Yale, and that's really the history of New England Christianity from 1700, down closely to our time. And I wrote a biography of my father, and that covered some of the modern period. But I think for the rest of my life, I'd better stick to the age of the Reformation. I haven't got too long left, and I'd better, I think, confine my efforts to the period that I know best.
Then we had one translated by Henry here, but I used it was too rough to be told me that you translated and left out the real hard stuff, and the real model translation to you. How accurate is that?
Well, first of all, with regard to Osborne, he starts off by having Luther in prayer with the monks, and then suddenly Luther comes to the front of the stage and grabs his stomach and says, "I'm not." Well, not what? He's grabbing his stomach all the way through. It makes you think that his religion originated in his entrails. It's the gastronomic Luther. this story of saying "I'm not" comes from a legend that originated after Luther's death and was published by his most virulent opponent, who got it only at fourth hand. The story was that when Luther was a monk and in the choir, the passage was read from the Gospel about the casting out of the demoniac. And Luther screamed, "I'm not." That is, "I'm not possessed of a devil. I'm not the demoniac," and fell swooning. Well, it's not incredible. He believed in demoniacal possession. And when he was depressed, he might have thought the devil had got him. But it's very poorly authenticated. And although Luther had plenty of bouts with the devil, he never once suggested that there was the possibility that he was possessed of the devil. As I say, he starts off with a legend. The best part of the play is Tetzel selling indulgences. That almost made you wish your ancestors were dead so you could get them out of purgatory. That was jolly good. And Cardinal Cajetan wasn't too bad. But the weakest character in the play is God. You don't feel he's around anywhere. You feel the Emperor Charles is up in the gallery. But the intensity of Luther's religious conflict and the way in which he came into the clear simply does not come out at all. That's the weakness. And in the end, Luther appears in the pulpit with a baby in one hand and the Bible in the other, and he said magnificent things about both. But in the play, it's a very feeble conclusion. So I would say, and as for the vulgarity, well, Luther talked a lot about physical functions, so also did Thomas More, and most people in that generation. The most genteel in that regard was Erasmus, and he wasn't too fastidious, but Luther did use a good deal of the language of physical elimination. But as I say, one thing to remember is that they lived in the midst of sewers. The sewers ran down the gutters. Everything smelled. And they talked about that kind of thing very freely. But another thing is that some of it comes out of the Bible. The Apostle Paul said he'd be willing to be dung for Christ. And one remembers such expressions as the bowels of mercy. I beseech you by the bowels of Christ. In a modern translation, it would be guts. And then the monks, in order to show how humble they were, described in some detail what it would be like to be dung for Christ. And all of that lay in the background of the kind of stuff that Luther read. So it's there. You get it primarily in the table talk. But there are volumes and volumes and volumes in which there's nothing more vulgar in Luther than there is in the Apostle Paul. And to center on that, rather than his magnificent translation of the Scriptures, his superb commentaries on the Bible, is just simply to pick on the inconsequential. You might just as well pick out the bawdy passages out of Shakespeare and say that's Shakespeare. And there's nothing bawdy in Luther on sexual matters. He's frank in discussing it, but he's not bawdy. It's elimination. It's scatology is the technical word for it, talking about dung and so on. And it's there, all right. But since you mentioned it, I might as well not be fastidious myself. In the middle of a play, in Osborne's play, Luther says, "If I pass wind, they smell it in Rome." Well now, it just comes right out of the blue. Luther did say it, but this was the context. He was talking to a nephew who was an alcoholic And when he was under the influence, he was guilty of violence. And Luther said to him, now look here, young fellow, you ought to abstain absolutely from alcohol. There are some people who can take a little extra, and when they do, they're jolly and they sing like my father. But you shouldn't touch it. And you should bear in mind what you're doing. You're bringing into bad repute your city, your family, and me. You should remember that I'm under the closest scrutiny, and if I pass wind, they smell it in Rome. Mm-hmm. Well, now, to say that to a boy like, of that character, well, actually, it's got a whole lot more punch than if he said, you should remember that the FBI are watching me. Well, now, it just isn't fair to take a thing like that and have it just come out of nowhere in the middle of a play. If you're going to use it at all, why, put in the whole thing. Now, as I say, he wasn't fastidious. On the whole, the Germans, in general, are not as fastidious on such matters as the Americans. The Americans are making what they think is a respectable word out of shit. It's coming to be used rather freely, as a matter of fact. Luther wasn't any worse than the young people of our generation at that point. But as I say, to fasten on that is to fasten on the inconsequential. And after all, elimination does not preclude illumination.
Dale has a session in here now at 4 o'clock. So. Thank you very much for the time you gave.
Well, thank you for gathering. If you want to, they asked me to do a drawing of the of the camp and of some of the people in it, and I had just here's Horty, and here's Werner Leo. This little dog, he runs around here. I don't know what the dog's name is. And I don't know the name. This is Falkenberg, isn't that? Falkenstern, yeah, with his camera. And I don't know who all the rest of them are. She has an unruly baby, and he's got a baby on around his neck. And this little girl is doing the somersault sort of business. So I've got in the young, and here are a couple who are a little more elderly, and a couple who are somewhat younger. So I've tried to get old and young and various varieties.
Very good.
But there's a certain discrepancy in style between all of this posting here and all of the open work down on the bottom. But if I filled in grass all over here, the figures wouldn't stand out. So I don't quite know how I could unify it. I put these lines across here to serve as a kind of a transition from the closed work to the open work. And to hit this black, I make that black and the dog black, and made these lines heavy. But it doesn't hold strictly together.
Okay.